Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, you've loved him in films like Ghostbusters and Miss Congeniality, and his new film, Everything's Jake, is now in wide release. Actor Ernie Hudson. Then, they're the remarkable talents behind one of the most highly acclaimed action thrillers of the year. From The Prodigy, actor Holt Boggs and director William Kaufman. Plus, the Movie Geeks welcome the director of the extraordinary documentary titled Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple, Stanley Nelson. Got a question for any of tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477 or log on to our chat room now. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie and Jerry.
Movie Geeks United is on the air. Grab the popcorn, sit back, relax, dim the lights, and get your geek on. How's everybody out there doing? My name is Jamie.
My name is Jerry.
Yeah, we're perfectly timed. Look at that. What a duo.
We are a duo. There's no doubt about that.
We work it.
You know, we're working, man. We've been working it, like, on the phone like for the last 2 days.
Yeah, that's true. We are the Movie Geeks, and we're very pleased to be with you all tonight. Got a great show upcoming this evening. And upcoming in the programs ahead, we got a great show on Sunday night as well, where we welcome the director of a great new basketball documentary called Quantum Hoops, and he's going to come on. He's going to tell us all about the journey to making that film.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story.
Rick Greenwald, yeah, it's a great gem of, you know, when you discover these slices of life, you know, that's what it feels like. It feels like a real discovery.
Absolutely.
The best documentaries always do. And then we might have something very special for you along the lines of a trivia contest Sunday. We're in the planning stages that might occur, so stay tuned for that as well. And, of course, on Sunday we'll also be delving in to the Golden Globe nominations that are announced tomorrow morning.
Among other things.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about that we got to catch up on, but that'll be a big story. We'll be able to delve into those nominations and scrutinize, you know, like we...
Yeah, no, we'll scrutinize we'll talk about it, you know, we'll have a lot of fun with it. We also have an announcement for tomorrow night, though.
That's right. We are going to be interviewed on Alan Levy's show. Now, Alan Levy, for those of you that are new to Blog Talk Radio, he is the CEO of Blog Talk Radio, which is the server that you're on right now that carries our show. Now, Alan Levy is a visionary. We had him on our show as a guest a couple of weeks ago, and now he's going to interview us on his show tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern. You'll be able to learn all about the Movie Geeks, anything you want to know. If you want to call in and ask questions, how do we do this, you know, what's our favorite movie, you know, any question that you might have, we'll be able to answer it for you on Mr. Levy's show. So that'll be exciting for us to be interviewed.
Yeah, I think it'll be a nice change of pace. We're very open on here. So, I mean, it's not too much. I mean, I'm about as transparent and superficial as they come. But so everyone, I think, already knows about that. So, but it'll be interesting.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. Hopefully no boxers or brief questions, though. But
that's exactly... I was going to actually bring that up. Yeah, if you want to know that, we'll be happy to tell you that, too. Nothing's out of bounds. It's all about open communication.
That's right. We're honest.
That's right. So a great show for you tonight. If you want to call in, you can do so at 718-508-9477.
Or you can log on to the chat room, and, you know, if you have a question, we'll try our best to get it to the appropriate guest.
Yeah, that is true. Our chat room is very lively. Just log on. You can talk about movies. Jerry's manning the chat room right now. He'll be able to communicate with you during the show. And you can submit, just like Jerry just said, you can submit questions through there.
I'm guest 708 if anybody's interested, just to know who I am in there. So
yeah, and it's great. The chat room is a great addition to the show.
I think it helps a lot. I think it's a very nice feature.
Very communal experience.
Yes, it is.
Okay, let's get started. Ernie Hudson is our first guest tonight. He is a wonderful actor who's appeared in a series of terrific films like Miss Congeniality, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, The Crow, The Cowboy Way, Sugar Hill, and Congo, and highly acclaimed television series like St. Elsewhere, ER, Desperate Housewives, and Oz. but he might be most widely recognized and beloved for his breakthrough role in Ghostbusters 1 and 2, films that continue to enchant and inspire legions of movie lovers more than 20 years after their initial release.
That's right.
We'll be speaking with Mr. Hudson tonight about his extraordinary career and one of his latest projects. Everything's Jake is a labor of love that is now hitting movie screens and DVD shelves across the country after a long and hard-fought seven-year journey. As the film's title character, Mr. Hudson delivers a remarkable performance that Variety praises as consummately warm and satisfying. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Ernie Hudson. Mr. Hudson, are you with us?
Yeah, I sure am. How you guys doing?
Doing great.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's an honor to have you on our show.
Well, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Now, I'm struck by the journey that this film has taken, Everything's Jake, because it does seem like such a labor of love for all involved, and I think it's that love and dedication that's resulted in its release now, 7 years after making it.
Yeah, it's very interesting how films now, you know, was a time all you had to do was make a movie and you're pretty, you know, sure of getting it out there, but now it's so much product. And we made this movie, every festival that, you know, it was in competition, it came away with some kind of award. We won Santa Barbara, we won the Big Apple in New York, and a number of the festivals, and but the studios didn't get it, and it took a long time, and I'd pretty much given up on the movie, and then by accident, or someone at Warner Brothers saw the movie, and they decided to release it on DVD, and we premiered at a couple theaters on the East Coast just to qualify for the different awards, but finally the movie is getting a chance to get out there, and at least people will have a chance to see it. It's always played well with audiences, but you know, you've got to, you know, people have to have access to it. So
yeah, that's just it.
Right.
For the audience that might not know, could you tell me a little bit about, tell us a little bit about what the film is about?
Yeah, it's a movie, and one of the reasons why I think it was had difficulty finding a distributor, it's a movie about a man who happens to be homeless.
Yeah.
The studios thought, well, this is a homeless movie. It's not really about a homelessness. It's about a man who happens to be homeless, but it's really about friendship. And it's a guy who's been on the street most of his life, and another man is on the streets recently and is not going to survive very long. And so they form a friendship, and then it's about betrayal of that friendship and, you know, all the things that sort of come out of it. I love the movie because there was something in the spirit of the character that really spoke to me, and I think it's a great American sort of story. It's a different kind of hero, in my opinion.
Yeah,
and,
I did read an interview where you talked about how you were really caught by the character's core values and his heroism in a way.
So, yeah.
Yeah. What are some of those qualities in that character that you found so appealing?
Well, you know, I think as a society where we run a risk of getting so caught up with the material, you know, things everybody talks about that, but and here's a man who makes a decision that he's not going to fall into that trap, and he's on the street by his choice. He looks at life as it is and says, okay, if this is what it is, you know, let me accept that, and then let me be the one who decides what to do with my life.
Right.
And so there are a lot of people who are running around desperate, and they look at him as if he somehow failed, but he's looking at them saying, but you're missing the whole point. It's life doesn't end when we lose our stuff. And I think that when we can look at our circumstances and still be true to who we are, to me that's very heroic.
Yeah, and he does form, like you said, a relationship with a friend, Cameron, I believe is his
Cameron, and also I think that's part of his. He sees that as his role. There are a lot of people you'll see in the movie who he sort of you know, takes under his wing. He looks out for. Phyllis Diller was kind enough to come and work on the movie, and she's wonderful in the film. But she plays an ex-chorus girl who sits outside the theater and is waiting to be called back, which of course will never happen. But really out of her mind. but he sort of, you know, he looks after her. Lou Myers plays a character who's an alcoholic and, you know, drug abuser, and he sort of, you know, takes care of him. So he has his people that he sees that as his role, and I think he sees himself. He's stronger, but he's strong enough to make the choice.
Yeah, I know you say that the film transcends just a plot device of homelessness, but
right.
I know that this was probably a down and dirty kind of independent film, but did you? How did you kind of immerse yourself in that world? Was there research involved for you?
Yeah, and you know, I had done some work with a number of rescue missions. The biggest one here, the Union Rescue Mission in Southern California, it's the largest and the oldest in the country. I have some familiarity with with that situation, some, and I don't want to overplay that, but and when I decided to do the role, it was very important for me to spend a little time I had actually intended to spend a lot of time living on the street, but that was one of those ideas that lasts for about 6 or 7 hours.
Right, right.
You know what, there's got to be an easier way than this. I mean, shot it in New York in December and January, and it's cold in New York. So,
oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
But we did go to a lot of the shelters, and we met a lot of people, and there was one character who I really based a lot of the character on, who was a guy who's been out on the street for about 8 years, and when he talked about it, he just sort of lit up, and you realize that life goes on. You know, life still happens no matter what your circumstance. And and that was, to me, that was amazing. I mean, you talk about this place where you can go and get the best soup at, you know, and then you go over here and they give, you know, clothes, and here you can wash your things, and he had a whole routine, his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pretty extraordinary. So because I think as an actor, it's a responsibility to bring the honesty to the movie. Now, one of the things that hurt the movie in some ways, because it wasn't a formula, there were things in the film, how do you go to the bathroom? I mean, how do you survive?
But
scene with prostitutes in the movie, that a lot of Christians who want to like the movie, but when they see the scene with the prostitute, they're totally turned off by it.
Right.
So the usual way we can sort of, we're conditioned for violence, but we're not conditioned to a guy taking a dump, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's, but we try to be, honest, you know, how do you find food? I mean, how do you eat?
That's just it. And if you're doing
it
right,
you need to show that.
If you're doing it right, you have a responsibility to
yes.
to keep up the authenticity of that life.
I think so. I think there's an integrity. And these guys, Matthew Mealy and Chris Fetchko, they wrote a great script, and I thought it was a great character. And I really felt that what we do as actors and directors, we're storytellers.
Oh yeah.
And I think we, you know, to bring truth, and that's what I find missing in so much of the product that comes out of Hollywood. There's something.
They sugarcoat it.
Yeah, they want it so much to make sure that it tries to make money that there's no truth there left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very hard to have truth when you're the bottom line is the bottom line.
Yeah,
the bottom line. And then suddenly they have a character do something totally out of character, and I go, what was that about? And so this was two guys who were very, I think, potentially really good filmmakers, and so they didn't have all those sort of, you know, preconceived ideas about what they could and couldn't do.
Yeah. The film's called Everything's Jake. It's out on DVD now, and it's screening, I believe, in various venues across the country as well.
Right.
But it is an independent film, and you've worked on independent films and big-budget films. Now, as an actor, does it affect the process, or is it all basically the same game?
Well, at some level, it's all about the work, which says, I guess, it's all basically the same game. The difference, though, is, you know, when you do a movie like Ghostbusters, I mean, you know, the per diem is great, you know, there's plenty
right.
of money, you know, you got a great, dressing room, trailer, life is a lot of fun. you know, you got a lot of toys. You know what I mean? You're well looked after, and all you have to do is, you know, sort of show up and do your thing. And you're on an independent film, and you're shooting outside, and it's cold, and you know, and there may not be any per diem, and certainly not making any money that's going to even pay your mortgage. It becomes a very, very different thing. So if you're going to make the sacrifice, you want to try to do it right.
Yeah. I've heard a couple of things about acting in an independent film as opposed to a big budget. Big budget, there seems to be a lot more. Your job is basically you feel a lot of times like you're getting paid to wait.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, and in an independent film, it allows for the hurried, the more hurried pace. And the limited budget actually allows for more creativity because it's not something that you can throw money at.
Sure, yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, no, you got to get it done. When I signed up to do this movie with these guys, and they got the script to me, and then once you say yes, then I know that wherever they're lacking, I got to make up the difference.
Mm-hmm.
If whatever it takes, if we want to get a good cast, if I left it up to them, I don't know what we'd end up with, but, you know, I called friends. I mean, Dougie Doug used to do the Cosby Show. I called Doug and Stephen Furst. We did St. Elsewhere together.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, yeah.
Debbie Allen, we did a movie called Women of San Quentin, and Debbie came, Robin Givens. I mean, you know, and you want to make sure that...
Lou Rawls is in it, too, as well.
Yeah, Lou Rawls. Yeah, I went to see Lou Rawls in New York, and he was performing there, and when the movie was over, we were talking, and... And he said, "Man, what's this movie about?" And I told him the story, and he said, "Man, I want to be in it." So
cool.
He came down, and we created this scene where he was a hot dog vendor, and he wrote a song on the spot, so he sings in the movie. But everybody, it just shows up 100%.
Yeah.
And that's what, because there's no glamour there. I mean, it's like we got to get this, and we don't have all day to get it.
Yeah, I bet. I want to go through briefly some of your previous work, which is extraordinary, some of the credits in your resume and what you've been able to accomplish. And I guess a great place to start would be Ghostbusters.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
That's still just so alive and thriving.
It's great.
20
it's
years
great.
After
it came
out. We're
doing the game now. We're doing the Ghostbuster. They've been doing this extraordinary cutting-edge technology for this new game that's coming out.
Yeah,
Danny Aykroyd and Harold Ramis—they're writing the script, and I mean, I'm not a big gamer, so I don't know a lot, but it's these—you know—they're really going to make this something really extraordinary. Bill, all the cast is back. Bill Murray is doing it, so we're all back.
And, the chat room is abuzz about this game, by the way.
yeah, it's and of course, Danny was saying he wanted to do the third movie, but since we couldn't somehow pull that off. The game is going to be our attempt to say, okay, this is for the fans.
So the movie itself is kind of development hell, as I would say, I guess, right now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not quite sure why. I'm sure,
I'd be first in line.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. I think, I go all over the world, and I mean, I don't care where I am. If I'm on the street, somebody's going to yell, "Who are you going to call?" You know, I mean, without fail, I'm telling you, it's... So the movie is still there, and people introduce the movie to their kids, and so I get kids 3-4 years old who, you know the movie and know the characters. And
oh, yeah.
Great.
It's timeless.
Yeah, it really is. And I've heard that these video games, to work on these video games, to do the voice, it's a lot of fun, actually. So it should be a fun process.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it'll be a great reunion, because some of these guys, I mean, I saw Harold Ramis, I gave him an award at the Austin Film Festival about a year or so back, and I see Danny Aykroyd from time to time, I haven't seen Bill Murray in a while, so it'd be great to get together with the guys.
Now, do you remember the first time you were kind of thrown in with that comedic trio?
I remember meeting. I met Harold. Harold Ramis. We did a movie called Space Hunter that he was one of the writers on.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that. Okay.
A year before, and Ivan Reitman was the executive producer. But when I this was a very, very different movie, and when I met the guys, all great guys, you know, but all sort of in their sort of own worlds in a weird way, and I was sort of left to kind of bridge the space between all of them somehow.
Right.
But it was great. I mean, I really I just have a lot of respect and a lot of love for them.
Another of your past films I want to ask you about was Weeds, and specifically working with Nick Nolte.
Well, you know, it's funny because it sort of ties into Ghostbusters, because I'd worked in movies about 8 years before Ghostbusters, and then Ghostbusters came out, and it was this phenomenon, and I couldn't get arrested. I mean, I couldn't get another movie for almost 3 years. It was the strangest thing, but it was all over the place, and I was signing autographs at the supermarket, but I could not, and I'm not quite sure how to explain it. But how that gets to Weeds is I finally got an interview to go in for this movie, Weeds, and I just thought, you know what, I'm getting this job. So I went in and met Nick Nolte. I had to sing a song at the interview that I actually ended up singing in the movie.
Right.
But I love Nick Nolte. He's a great guy. I just to me, he's one of those guys who really have this sort of star charisma.
He's a force of nature.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, he's, you know, Nick would look so, I mean, just burn out in the mornings, you know, and then suddenly they turn, you know, they say action, and all of a sudden this whole other being came through, and I would sit there in the scene and go, oh, my God, I mean, this is, you know, he lights up like a Christmas tree, and then suddenly it's cut, and then he's back to being burnt out again. But
oh well,
that was extraordinary.
When did you realize that this is what you wanted to do? Because I thought I read that you started out as a writer, didn't you?
I started as a writer because I didn't somehow think being an actor was legitimate enough. You know, I mean,
it
seemed like a lot of people were talking about, but I think writing was something, and I do like the idea of storytelling. I got my undergraduate work at Wayne State University. I got a scholarship to Yale in the playwriting program, and but I think I wanted to write, but I think I always loved acting. You know what I mean? I think writing was somehow something I thought would just be more adult, responsible. But acting was something that it was just fun to do, and I think the reason I'm still doing it is because it's always been fun.
Yeah. Can you articulate what kind of urge it satisfies in you, acting? Because I find that actors, there's no two ways about it. They have to act.
Yeah, I think it's a calling. I really do. I think it's a calling. I said we are storytellers. You know, in tribal societies, you know, the stories are how we define ourselves, how we find our place in society. I think that it's still the case, and I think we do that through movies. You know, we watch how the guy gets the girl. We learn about ourselves.
Yeah.
And there's something about needing to act. I mean, this is what I do, and you know, you work for, I mean, all these years I'm still trying to get it right, and then of course you bring a lot to it, but then getting the chance to do that, it's it gets harder and harder, which gets me back to the writing, because now I'm realizing that there's certain stories that if I want told, I have to create that myself.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, acting is I love the idea of all the possibilities that I could have been. I mean, there's some part of me that could have been homeless. I've never been homeless, but, you know, there's some part of me that could have been all these various sides of me.
Mm-hmm.
that I find fascinating, you know, all the many different things that we do. And yet there's always that belief that I've always had that on some level we're all tied into the same mind.
Yeah.
So in essence, we're all pretty much, you know, the same. We're all, you know, we're all one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think somehow these various characters kind of reflect that.
Yeah. With all the experience and all the extraordinary people that you've worked with and these projects, is there a single most important piece of advice or lesson that you've learned about the craft of what it is you do?
Well, I think the people who I sort of admire the most, I've worked with, there's a sort of down-to-earth understanding that it's just a job. And even though sometimes in society they take it a little more serious, you can't, you know, take it that way or make more out of it than it actually is. It's, you know, this is what I do. Somebody else is a plumber, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a gig. It does not make you any more special than anyone else. You know, you do the best work you can, and then that's that. You don't, you're not entitled to any special favors because of it or whatever. I mean, it's
yeah.
You know,
and I think that audiences respond to that too. I mean, they know when your aims are true. They sense
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
they sense genuine.
Yeah,
they really do.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. I think there's I mean, I love what we do, but it's I think sometimes people feel that they have some kind of special entitlement because of it. And
right, right.
I don't sort of buy into that. And the, and like I said, the real people. I remember doing Fantasy Island years ago, the television series, and.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a bunch of names. You always have the special celebrities on. And I felt a little awkward, so I kind of went to my trailer, and I was sort of there. And then Ricardo Montalban, he knocked on the door, and he says, "I'm Ricardo." And he sort of he invited me out. He introduced me, and he says, "Welcome to Fantasy Island." He was just so gracious. He's the only actor I've ever written a thank you note because he was just so generous and kind. And I thought, you know, I always want to be able to do that when I'm working, because you know it doesn't take much, but it really makes a huge difference.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about Everything's Jake, but you have a before you leave, I want to talk about some of these other films. If you could mention them briefly about some of your upcoming films you have.
Sure, yeah. There's well, there's a number of things. One thing is not a film actually. It's a CD that's come out called. I'm going blank on it. It's my wife's in the other room. We always sort of feel these. I think it's called The Word of Faith. Anyway, me, Stacey Keach, Jim Caviezel, Lou Gass. What is it even called? Is it Word of Promise? Word of Promise. Okay. My wife, she feels the those missing spots in.
Yeah.
Anyway, but it's a great cast, and it's the King James version of the New Testament, so it just came out, and so that's kind of cool. It's fun to do.
Oh, goodness, wow.
But there's a movie called Nobel's Son that played at Tribeca. It's going to screen in Sundance, and it's being released March 20th with Alan Rickman and Bill Pullman, Murray Steenburgen.
Wow.
Oh, and Nobel's Son? Is that what
Nobel's
you said?
Nobel's Son, yeah, and it's a really fun movie. So that's coming. They have a release date for that. There's a movie called All Hat that I shot a year ago in Toronto.
Uh-huh.
Played at the Toronto Film Festival with Keith Carradine, Rachel Lee Cook, Lou Kirby, and it's a really cool movie about the horse racing community up around Toronto. Sort of a modern day Western.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I think they're trying to get a release somewhere around spring. There's one called Lonely Street with Jay Moore and Joy Mantegna.
Yes,
and
yeah.
A bunch of other guys. And it's I think it's, I haven't seen it yet, but it should be coming out soon, I would hope. But it was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, but you stay busy.
You gotta stay busy. You know, at a certain point, you gotta. You know, also I think it's just it's good to be active. It's just good to. Keep doing what we do. So, you know, I've been very blessed.
Well, we'll keep at it. You're a remarkable actor. And
yes, thank you very much for being on.
And thank you so much.
For taking the time. I mean, I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're welcome back anytime you'd like, sir.
Great. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much. Now, bye-bye.
Right. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Ernie Hudson. His new movie is Everything's Jake. You can find it at, and I have the web address. Hang on. Give me a second. EverythingsJakeFilm.com. It'll give you all the information you'd want from the film, the trailer, the press materials about how it was made, where it might be screening, where it's available on DVD. Just a wonderful looking, heartwarming film, and authentic and truthful, like the best independent work should be. I mean, yeah, we talk about big budget, we talk about indie films, but
yeah.
We expect something truthful, for the most part, from our indie films.
Right, we do. I think that's a very good point.
Yeah, because they are independent. You know, that's the very nature of that term, independence.
Mm-hmm.
This is a film that is like that. So I urge everyone to check that out. Check out that website. And Ernie Hudson, fantastic actor. We couldn't be more honored to have him on our show tonight. How's the chat room doing, Jerry?
The chat room's doing good. We're talking about. All right, I do have a...
It really spiked with that Ghostbusters thing, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. we know. There was one guy on here that we have is doing, like, who knows a lot about a lot of websites and is doing making his own Ghostbusters website. So that's really cool.
I went on that Ghostbusters message board today, and I posted that Mr. Hudson would be with us tonight.
Yeah.
So,
oh, that's great. I mean, we got a lot of people for that. Also, I have there's a gentleman on here, a person that they want to know how, if they should be hearing sound and how they get sound.
Now, there's a above the player, I think there's a switch that click to open up a new window. If you have Windows Media, if you click that, it will it'll come up on a full screen.
Okay.
So that you can then minimize it. You can hear the show. I don't know. I haven't been
right.
Since I run the board and I host the show,
right?
You,
no, I
I'm not in a position to be able to hear myself.
Yeah, I know. I hear you, man.
But try that. I wasn't even aware that you couldn't hear it without.
Yeah.
I think you need two different windows open,
yeah,
if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, that's my expert opinion.
Okay.
I know nothing about computers. I'm sorry. I just co-host a talk show with you, Jerry.
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is, because I only hear through the phone, so I don't know.
Yeah.
On the computer.
Yeah, yeah. But that was a wonderful, time with him.
It was great. And, it sounds like he was talking about how difficult it is to sell that kind of movie.
Yeah,
And it's a very, it's a very interesting genre, because I don't know if you remember a Tim Hunter movie back in the early 90s with Matt Dillon and Danny Glover, The Saint of Fort Washington.
Yes, yes.
That was a very good movie, but that's a tough, I don't think that got a theatrical release.
It's hard. I think it went straight to cable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough for some of these films to make it. But we thank Mr. Hudson for joining us.
Absolutely.
It's something that I got the sense from Raymond J. Berry last week. I respond to people that have a passion for what they do.
It's infectious.
And you could hear it from Raymond Berry, and you could hear it from Ernie Hudson then. I don't care if you're an actor or what position you have in life, if you have a passion for what it is you
right.
do, there's nothing more inspiring to me than that. Anyway, let me wipe a tear from my eye.
Okay, all right. No, that's a good point, because, if the person, you watch some of these interviews on TV, the press junkets, people must be tired. They're doing, the same interview, the same question for, 40 hours.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
There's so many of them. They have that passion. They don't get tired from the process. This is what they love to do, and
mm-hmm.
it shows. It really does show for most of the time.
Our next guests are on the line.
Okay.
And I'm really excited to talk about this movie. This is a great movie. So this is going to be exciting. Mike Watt from FilmThreat.com calls it a little come-out-of-nowhere masterpiece, while Ron Kruger of the Hollywood Foreign Press praises it as absolutely riveting. And these are just two of the countless accolades this film has received since its successful run in film festivals to its recent DVD release. It would be rare for even the largest studio films to receive this kind of audience and critical praise, but it's even rarer still when it's inspired by an independent suspense thriller with a first-time feature film director at the helm. The Prodigy is the new film from writer-director William Kaufman and writer-star Holt Boggs. This gorgeously shot and impeccably acted crime story is sure to please even the most jaded film fans, as it seamlessly blends elements of intense action and horrific violence with a unique and authentic look at a criminal underworld. Tonight, we are pleased to be joined by both William Kaufman and Holt Boggs. Let me bring them up. Mr. Kaufman, are you with us?
Yes, I am. How are you doing?
Hi, and Mr. Boggs?
Yes, sir.
Thank you both for being with us tonight. It's a great pleasure to have you both on with us.
Oh, most definitely. Thanks for having us.
I can't wait to talk to you about this film. But first of all, give me a sense of how you both got started, when you knew that film would be your life. William, if we can start with you.
Yeah, for me, as a little kid, grade school, I was making little Super 8 movies with my buddies and things like that. It's something I've always wanted to do.
Yeah. Were there idols of yours when you were growing up that you kind of looked
upon?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, they're the people like, obviously, Spielberg and Cameron. I'm a huge Luc Besson fan, obviously, and Michael Mann, and guys that I just Carpenter, John Carpenter, you'll definitely see little bits and pieces of his influence in my work.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned also, I saw in the press notes, that you mentioned you're greatly influenced by the film The Hitcher.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Robert Harmon's version of The Hitcher.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah.
It is.
And Holt, when did you know that performance would be your life?
You know, it kind of fell upon me on accident. You know, when I was younger, my father always used to take me to the movies all the time, and he forced me to watch everything from old Harold Lloyd stuff, Buster Keaton stuff, when I used to see him on the weekends to, you know, we watched movies almost every weekend, but it was never really something I ever really aspired to be.
Right.
About, you know, my early mid-20s, I kind of thought, well, hey, looks like a decent job, and at least it's not a 9-to-5. How hard could it be? And
right.
I went to a 2-year conservatory program in Texas, oddly enough, and I luckily got in because I figured, you know, yeah, I'll go get to meet some girls and figure out what acting was all about. And that's when I started falling in love with, you know, I hate sounding cliche, but when the bug got me, I started studying Sam Shepard and David Mamet and a lot of the great playwrights and really getting into the craft of what acting was. And from then I just knew, that was it for me. So
yeah, and this might sound odd, but congratulations on your name, first of all, because that's a movie star name right there.
Thanks.
Yeah.
It's his real name.
I hope it is. Yeah, I hope it is. So
Now, Will, I know that you worked your way through a variety of kind of crew positions, and one of these experiences was as a production assistant on Good Morning Vietnam. Is that true?
Yeah, I grew up overseas. My father was in banking, and I was in high school. I went to an American school in Bangkok, and they were shooting Good Morning Vietnam and a movie called Off Limits. I think it was called something else here, but Gregory Hines and Willem Dafoe.
Mm.
And that was kind of my introduction to real film sets, you know, running around and being a PA, and it was fantastic. I actually got to audition for Barry Levinson and had no idea who he was at the time. He was a young high school kid, you know, freshman.
Yeah, that's great. And you both met, you and Holt, you both met on the set of a short film that you were doing?
Yeah, I was doing a short film, and one of my lead actors dropped out. Holt was actually playing a very small role in it, and the lead actor dropped out like 2 days beforehand, and luckily Holt jumped in, and the rest was kind of history. We just really hit it off.
Yeah, and Holt, I know that you're in an enviable position of you kind of switch back between theater and film quite a bit, and I know you mentioned Mamet and Shepard, but is there a different discipline involved for you making that transition between theater and film?
Yeah, you know, one thing that, and it was funny because you asked that because I just talked to Will about this on the phone not too long ago, is with doing The Prodigy, and I've done some other shorts with him and stuff, there's a tremendous difference between theater and film acting, which I know everybody knows, but, you know, in school, everything was theatrically based, and everything was about, and theater's different because it's organic in a way that you're looking at someone who is physically there,
mm-hmm.
and you're having true emotion as it follows in the story, where film is shot out of order and so forth and so on, and sometimes you're looking at the tape mark to the left of the camera, and that's supposed to be the character you're speaking to. And so I enjoy both, but film work for me sometimes is a bit more difficult because of the time constraints. A lot of times as an actor, you're sitting around waiting for the crew and everybody to get ready for you to do your emotional scene 17 times, you know what
sure,
I mean?
Yeah.
And say your three lines or whatever. So it's it's a different world, and they're two totally completely different animals for me, so.
Yeah, but you're fantastic in the film, and the film
Thank
is
you.
Fantastic. I mean, it's action-packed, and the cinematography is just first-rate. It's just a kick-ass film, if you don't mind me saying so.
No.
Oh, I don't think.
tell me the...
His name is Mark Rutledge, by the way.
Tell me the origins of this film, William, how the idea of this started to come about.
Well, originally, you know, Holt was going to write a short film, and we started kicking around a story, and he started writing the short, and the short really was the third act of the film.
Mm.
And we fell in love with this bad guy, and said, you know, hey, this is this is something a little different. This is something really cool. We just couldn't let it go, and it expanded. And we said, you know, we're gonna do this. And we looked at what we had done, our short film together, what that had cost us. And we had this romantic idea that you just multiply the minutes, and that's all it'll cost.
Right.
And that's kind of, this was a chance to do the kind of story that, you know, hopefully if we have a real career in this industry that Hollywood wouldn't typically have let us.
They're unfamiliar. A little bit about the plot of the film and your character, Truman.
Yeah, basically, I play a character, Truman Fisher, who, the nuts and bolts of him, he's a small-town thug, never really did anything right, did a lot of stuff wrong, works for a sleazy nightclub owner, basically doing odds and ends job, collecting money from people who owe his boss money, that kind of thing.
Right.
In the film, there's the character, the Rains character, is looking for someone to continue his quote-unquote work as an assassin, a killer of mythical proportions. And he sees something in my character and decides to, basically put him through a rite of passage by destroying him, you know.
Right.
That's basically the nuts and bolts. So it's a kind of a cat-and-mouse game, you know.
And that's kind of how we compare it to thematically to The Hitcher.
Right.
Where our Reigns is the John Ryder, and
mm-hmm.
Holt's character is kind of the C. Thomas Howell character.
Yeah, I can see that definitely. And you both co-wrote the script together with the co-star of the film, right? There was a third writer involved, or
yeah, he kind of came in. That's Matt Beckham.
Yes.
He script doctored some of the kind of the Reigns character dialogue.
Okay.
He was a big asset.
So tell me about that process, how a writing collaboration works.
I'll try. I've never collaborated before, and I hadn't really written much before, so I don't really know how that normally goes, and I don't know if it was orthodox. But basically, Will and I kind of sat down and kind of outlined what the story was going to be from A to B, A to Z, basically. And what I think in retrospect I probably would have done different, I don't know how Will speaks about this, but we basically, we took every other scene and with an idea of what the scene was supposed to be about, and we each wrote like basically every other scene to begin with. There were some pluses to that. I actually moved in with Will and his wife at the time and slept on the floor because we were trying to bust out a first draft in a reasonable amount of time. But it was odd taking every other scene because sometimes when you put the scenes together, they didn't juxtapose correctly.
Yeah, yeah. We have
a learning process.
I'm sorry. Go right ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say it was a learning process. So it's that was then, this is now, but that's how we attacked it initially.
Yeah, and what strikes me about it, I know that it's going to strike many people when they see it, is that usually when you watch an independent film, you're aware of the limitations of the budget and this and that.
Right.
But the way you didn't seem to attempt to compensate with your writing. I mean, your screenplay opens with an exciting gun battle and a choreographed fight scene that runs the better part of a half an hour. I mean, that's unheard
yeah.
of for an independent film. And I guess what amazes me is, how did you do it?
One of the things is, we knew going into it that, as you said, everyone's going to look at the cover of this box and go, okay, nobody's in it. I've never heard of this director. There's nobody bankable to it. And it was to really assault the audience with everything and to do what we thought we could do well, which was this kind of hit them hard with this action sequence to say, hey, this isn't just little indie film where people are kind of trying to learn how to do things. It was grabbing, you know, our little band of brothers of about six people.
Yeah.
And giving it everything we had. And I came from, I'd interned in movie effects and gun effects and everything, so I was able to lean on my effects coordinator, a great guy named Neil Stockstill, and two stunt coordinators who kind of switched off and filled in how they could and gave us their time. And
that proved invaluable for this film, let me tell you.
Absolutely.
That's a really exciting opening sequence. It was jaw-dropping. Let me take a call. We have an 864 area code on the line. 864, go right ahead.
Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Hey.
Doing good.
Great, great. Yeah, I just want to tell you that I'm a huge fan of The Prodigy. This was a great movie that really proves that you don't need, you know, a $30 million budget to make a great action film. So my hat's off to you, Will.
Thank you.
My first question is, how were you able to do so much with so little? You know, not having the $30 million budget and sort of being under that.
Well, I mean, again, it comes down to, we all looked at this as not a vehicle to make money, but as a vehicle to try and get a career going. So we all kind of came on as, whether we're credited as producers or not, what I mean by that is this crew of about six people. You know, we just gave everything. We kind of had an equal partnership in it. And everyone gave up their time. And so every penny that you see is up on the screen. And, you know, obviously we begged, borrowed, and stole every favor we could.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if I can jump in there as well, too, one thing that helped us out a lot is we shot in small towns in Texas, which invited us in because they were excited about the fact that we were shooting a movie. Versus going to a bigger city that has a day rate of such and such for production there. We shot up in Denison, Texas, which was just thrilled to death that, you know, movie guys were going to be shooting a film there. So we got the hotel we shot in was an old 1920s hotel. They let us shoot there for free in the big gun battles and everything for free. So we were able to use the most out of our dollars by, you know, trying to angle and hustle deals like that. So, you know, we didn't have the required permits that we needed to shoot certain street things, and so.
Caller, what's your name?
My name's Jay.
Hey, Jay. The Prodigy is a fantastic movie. You had a lot of fun with it?
Absolutely. It's one of the I've got it. I own it. I've actually bought some copies for Christmas for some of my friends. There's so much hidden detail in that film. It truly was a joy to watch. I actually have a question for Holt if we have time.
Go right ahead.
Hey, I appreciate it. Holt.
Yeah.
We love the Truman character, and we really thought that you brought a lot of cool things out of that particular character, and it was really a memorable performance. What were some of the things you did to sort of prepare for that?
For me, Truman is far removed from who I am as a person, so it was, but I also wrote him as such. I wanted to play a character that had a bunch of hills and valleys and had to go through a bunch of different things. Physically, I went and hung out in some old boxing gyms and stuff down in downtown Dallas. I hung around crowds that I probably wouldn't normally do. I also went and talked to some ex-convicts, just to learn more about their lives and kind of what they went through and lived through and so forth and so on. I had one guy was
the other member of our cast, right?
Yeah. He taught me how to make a shank out of a T-bone, and told me about he blew a guy's face off with a shotgun and so forth and so on. And the talking to people and living, it's two separate things, but it gave me an idea of an understanding of a world that I wasn't familiar with, being from work, you know, I grew up. So, and then also too physically, I did a lot of all of my own fight stuff in there. I was in the gym working with fight choreographer Ron Blicky, who was working with me day in and day out to get the moves and everything and more the fighting mentality of who Truman was,
Yeah, it is a physical performance. It really does carry a lot of emotional and physical demands, that part.
Go ahead.
I really enjoyed it, especially the boxing. The fight scene in the bathroom was just incredible.
Cool. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It just looked so real.
Did
come
up. Jay, thank you so much for calling in, and thanks for listening to the show tonight.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you. Good luck, guys. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, man. Bye-bye. Man, you have to love hearing that.
Yeah, no, good.
Yeah, makes my day.
Now, you mentioned the locations, and that's another thing that impressed me about the film. The locations look very unique, and they just add instant production value. And many of these locations, as it turns out, have historical relevance in the criminal world, don't they? Did I read that somewhere?
Absolutely. Most of the clubs and, like the hotel that Holt was mentioning, the Hotel Denison was an old haunt of like Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde, and they'd have little back room, you know, entrances and so forth, and brothels, and the Ashes location was one of our characters is this computer hacker character, and she, her location was an ex-brothel, you know, and then there was a club downtown Dallas. You know, we shot it in Dallas, and I think the rest of America kind of thinks of Dallas as, you know, either J.R. Ewing or Walker, Texas Ranger.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and there's a very different side to our city, and that was one of the things that we wanted to show, that that there's a real urban dirtiness. I mean, we specifically never mentioned the name of the city.
Mm-hmm.
We just wanted it to be some little dirty city in the South. And I think that was trying to capitalize on these kind of unique urban locations that we could showcase.
Yeah, and it just lends your film just an atmosphere and a mood that's just priceless, really. Now, this is currently available on DVD now, and just in time for the holidays. I think Walmart's a big carrier of this picture, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. I do know that in some territories it's been hard to get a hold of just because it's been out of stock. But if they don't have it, Walmart will order it for you, and you know, they'll send it directly to that store, and you can pick it up there.
Yeah. Is there any other online venues to order this through?
Amazon.
Okay.
And let me think. I know it's available for rent everywhere, like Blockbuster, Netflix, all that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And it's doing well. I mean, you mentioned Walmart is selling out. I mean, it's flying off the shelves. That's fantastic. So this is your calling card. Tell me what the future holds for both of you now. Starting with you, Holt, I guess. Holt, are you with us? Did we lose Holt?
Okay, I'm sorry. Here it was. I apologize. Technical difficulties there. I'm working on a few projects right now. I'm writing another screenplay that Will's going to be directing, hopefully the second or third quarter of next year, called The Wicked Garden. Other than that, I just finished smaller roles in two independent features that recently shot, and I was trying to make my mark in television, but there's a little strike out here right now that might put a damper on that. So,
yeah, that really does.
That'll do it.
Do you have any sense of, I mean, I don't know how many guild members you know, but do you have any sense of when this thing might work itself out, if it has any promise of doing that anytime soon? Go ahead, William.
Sorry. I do know that when they walked out, when the guild walked out Friday,
yeah,
that was a very kind of a black moment for everyone. And the impression is that, you know, obviously the pilot season has been killed, and that this could last easily until June.
So yeah, we hear
it's looking pretty grim.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that they're actually going to start communicating with the Directors Guild for those upcoming negotiations before they return to the writers. That's the rumor I've heard. So William, what about you? I know you're working on a film called Saints and Sinners. Am I correct?
Yeah, Sinners and Saints. Yeah, that's my baby right now. And besides the one, this project that Holt's writing for us. So, but Sinners and Saints is the next project up, and it's hopefully we'll be getting rolling in early March. It's an action crime thriller set in New Orleans post Katrina.
Oh, that's great! So you would have to shoot New Orleans there, wouldn't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I've got some fantastic people on the NOPD there, and some great film industry people people that helped us with Prodigy, the stunt coordinator and effects coordinator. So it's kind of in a way kind of going home.
Yeah. Yeah,
fantastic city.
Well, I'm crazy about your film, guys, and anything you guys do in the future, please come back and talk to us about it. You're more than welcome to.
Oh, definitely. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you both.
Have
a great night.
All the best.
The movie is called The Prodigy. It's available on DVD now. It's a great action thriller, suspense. Even as a horror fan, you'll get something out of it because there are definite elements of that in there as well. It's available on DVD now, The Prodigy.
Excuse me, Jamie.
Yes.
Do we have anyone from a 260 area code call in?
No.
Okay, because there's a guy, you know, the guy trying to listen to the show, trying to get the Windows Media to work. I told him to call in, and I was hoping he would call in, but I don't think he's in the chat room anymore, but I was hoping.
We have no one on the line.
Okay.
So I'm very sorry if there was a line open and I didn't get to it or didn't see it, and you had a question. I'm very sorry for that.
But
I'm doing the best I can.
No, I know. I realize that. I think we do have to reiterate when we're doing the show. We don't have the show. We're doing this through a telephone, so we don't have the show on our computers.
Yeah, and it's not like we don't have a producer in a booth somewhere.
Yeah.
And there's no pre-screening of a phone call.
We don't have a Robin, like, on Howard Stern or anything like that.
Yes, exactly. That would be a good idea, though.
That would be.
So we really are walking a high wire.
Yes, and we are trying to get, and we do apologize for any technical difficulties that you are having at home.
But we will look into that, because
yes.
I wasn't aware of that you couldn't hear. See, me, when I log in, I can hear it on my computer.
Right.
Any other shows that I log into, as I'm on the chat room, it's all on the same page.
Right.
But some people, I think there's a problem with Apple computers.
Yeah, I know that there's a problem with Apple.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Who knows? I think the 260 is on the line right now.
Okay, you want
to pick it up right now? Let me see. 260, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Yes, hold there.
I'm sorry, man. They just went off the air.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Oh, it's all right.
I'm sorry, man. But thank you for calling in. And thanks for listening tonight. Did you get to see the Prodigy?
Yeah. I saw it. And I actually bought it and stuff.
That's a kick-ass movie, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's a great action movie, man. But 260, thanks for calling in, man. I'm sorry.
We're sorry you missed it.
Oh, it's all right. I just got off the phone with Ron, so I was going to tell him about it so he could, talk about it too, since he played the bad guy. And stuff,
right.
Oh, wow. Oh, so, that would have been great.
I'm very sorry about that.
Oh, it's all right.
So thank you, 260. Thanks for listening tonight.
Yep.
Thank you.
No problem.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
So a lot of support out there for The Prodigy.
Yeah, there is. That's great.
It is a good movie. It deserves to be seen. So go out to your stores right now and pick it up. That's an order.
Okay.
We're three minutes away from the top of the hour, where we're going to welcome Stanley Nelson. He is the director of the documentary film Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple. And it's a documentary I saw a few months back.
And
it just astounded me.
It's one of those films. That story is just...
Yeah, and it's a story that has been told before in a sensationalistic manner, and you can't blame these filmmakers for doing that, because there's so much sensationalism in the actual story.
Right.
But this one really got down into the nuts and bolts of what the People's Temple was.
Right.
I think the key to the whole movie is the first line from one of the survivors that say, "I never set out to join a cult." I mean, nobody sets out to join a cult.
That's very true.
And the movie kind of takes it over from there. It's a fantastic work. And we look forward to welcoming Mr. Nelson in a couple of minutes. As soon as his number shows up on our board, we'll patch him in for the live interview. But big news tomorrow morning, the Golden Globe nominations.
That's true.
Yes. Now, Golden Globes, they obviously have comedy categories as well as dramatic.
Yeah.
They have a musical comedy category, as well as the regular dramatic kind of category.
Yes.
So it's a lot more of an open field than what the Oscars offer.
True.
And as a result, honestly, there's some work that passes through that you wouldn't normally consider award noteworthy.
That's true. You could definitely say that. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, though. What do you think now? Let's just look at the comedy and musical. What do you think will be up for that?
Hairspray, is that this year?
I would think Hairspray, I would think Sweeney Todd, I would think Knocked Up, Waitress.
Right. I would be happy with all those, actually.
I would be happy with all those, and I'd be curious to see if this new, the one where we had Raymond J. Barry, Walk Hard.
Walk Hard, yeah.
I have a feeling that might be up there.
It could be. I hear that the music is not bad in Walk Hard.
Like, I hear it, and I saw a trailer for it again last night. I couldn't stop laughing, but
it looks
just me.
Funny. And you know that John C. Reilly's touring the country as that character.
Yes.
Which is priceless. That's like a level of dedication. That's every bit as method actor as De Niro shaving his head into a mohawk and Taxi Driver.
And gaining the weight for Raging Bull.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean, that's a dedication we're finding now with our comedians. More than anyone else.
That's true.
With Sacha Baron Cohen and
but definitely Sacha Baron Cohen.
And where you live inside the skin of that character, yeah. That must be hard to get out of.
Yeah, you know who else is really, I guess really, and he will probably, I would imagine he will be up for a nomination for Sweeney Todd, is Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
He just seems to get into whatever character he plays. It's amazing.
Yeah, he's a fantastic actor, and I think there's something special that happens to him mm-hmm. when he works with Tim Burton.
Oh, yeah, they have I think, you know, like De Niro and Scorsese, and, you know, there's some other, but he has that relationship with him. It is special. It's magical when they work together.
Yeah, and honestly, I like Tim Burton very much, but there seems to be there are people that you consider visual directors.
Right.
There are people that you consider performance directors.
Mm-hmm.
I would think somebody like Sidney Lumet, you'd think actor's director.
Oh, absolutely.
But Johnny Depp really comes alive in Tim Burton films. They seem to have the same kind of perspective, dark perspective on
mm-hmm.
things that they can't get from any other kind of collaborators. It seems to be a match made in heaven.
Yes, I mean, it's funny, though, that Johnny Depp really does, I mean, it doesn't, whatever he's really, for the most part, whatever he's done, like Donnie Brasco or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, or, you know, even the Pirates films, when he's not on screen, those films don't really do it for me, but when he's on screen, they're wonderful.
Yeah. I believe our next guest is on the line.
Cool.
And this is terrific. Can't wait to talk to our next guest. The events of that day have been written about in sensationalized ad nauseum, the infamous tainted Kool-Aid, the eerily dislocated tone of cult leader Jim Jones as he instructed his followers through an early morning of mayhem, the babies being force-fed poison by their own parental protectors. But now, almost 30 years after 900-plus men, women, and children befell a mass suicide at the Jonestown compound, director Stanley Nelson dares to look behind the sensationalism and uncovers the truth about Jim Jones and, most importantly, the mission of the People's Temple, a peaceful and all-inclusive utopian society unbound by class or social ranking. The film is called Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple, and it's just the latest remarkable accomplishment in the career of this extraordinary filmmaker, whose previous documentary credits include Marcus Garvey, Look for Me in the Whirlwind, and the highly acclaimed The Murder of Emmett Till, which went on to earn Mr. Nelson an Emmy and a special jury prize at Sundance. It is a great honor to welcome Mr. Stanley Nelson to our program. Mr. Nelson, are you with us?
I sure am. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us. I've been so excited to talk to you about this film ever since I saw it a few months back, and it just will not leave me. It stays with me. It's a remarkable film. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about that. But tell me about your how you got started working documentaries, what it was about the documentary form that spoke to you.
Well, it's really funny. I kind of fell into it. I went to film school at City College in New York, and you know, I had no interest in documentaries, really. I got a job with a documentary film company, and you know, just fell in love with it, and fell in love with making films and kind of working in films. I think that's one of the great things about documentaries is you know, if you're really lucky, you spend a lot of time making films rather than planning them or thinking about them,
yeah.
or trying to figure out how to do them, but you really spend a lot of time making films.
Do you, I'm sorry to hit you with such a heavy question right off the bat, but do you feel that documentaries have the power to change lives or at least to alter thought in some way?
I think so. And sometimes, I mean, you know, I think we don't want to say that films, you know, can do more than they actually can do, but I think that, you know, right now, you know, it's really just a really golden time for documentary films.
Mm.
I think that documentary films can do so much that we're not getting in feature films, you know, that we're not getting in TV. You know, we kind of don't go beyond you know, the surface of so many stories, and documentary films can really do that. And I think that people are open to docs now. You know, people are really you know, used to seeing docs and wanting to see documentary films and wanting to think about things in a different way, and it frees documentary filmmakers to do things in a different way and try to you know, really put some kind of creativity and art into what we do.
Yeah, what do you attribute to that kind of rise of the documentary form that we've seen these past few years?
You know, I think so many things are coming together at once. I mean, I think that in some ways, you know, people are so disappointed by what's coming out of Hollywood and what's coming out of TV. I think that people, you know, are kind of getting used to documentary films in a lot of ways for different ways. I mean, people are seeing, you know, reality shows, which are kind of docs, you know. And I think people have seen documentary films and have really been inspired by them. So, you know, you go to see, you know, one of Michael Moore's films and you say, wait a minute, you know, this is really entertaining. You know, or you go see Inconvenient Truth and you say, wow, you know, I learned something, but I also was entertained by it. And so it makes you open to wanting to see another film. So I think that there's a lot of things that are happening. I think there's just more documentary films being made, too. I mean,
yeah.
The equipment is easier to use and lighter and cheaper. And so there's more things that are coming out.
Yeah, definitely. So what sparked the idea for Jonestown for you?
You know, it's one of those funny things where I heard People's Temple members on the radio. It was one of the anniversaries, I think it was the 25th anniversary of the death in Guyana, and I heard some members on the radio, and the story that they were telling was so different from the story that I thought I knew. You know, I, like so many people, you know, had heard the story. I was around at the time when the people died, and you know, I thought I knew the beginning, middle, and end. That, you know, over 900 people went out to the jungle, and they were crazy, and they followed this crazy man to their death. But when I heard them on the radio, they were talking about a People's Temple that I had never heard about this church that was socially active, that was integrated, that had these kind of high ideals, you know, that wasn't crazy. They weren't talking, you know, craziness about a spaceship landing from outer space or anything like that. They were talking about changing the world that we know. And I think, you know, it sounded so good. And that's kind of what got me, you know, interested in the story.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yes.
We have a question in the chat room
yes.
from Mr. Nelson. One of our listeners wants to know, did you discover elements of Jim Jones that you weren't aware of, good or bad, while making the film?
I think there were so many things that you know, we discovered in making the film. I mean, one of the things that we came to really early on was that, you know, if these people weren't crazy for joining People's Temple, then how are we going to portray them? You know, how are we going to show that there was some good in People's Temple? You know, if they weren't crazy, why did they join People's Temple and why did they stay?
Right.
And so in the first third or so of the film, you know, we really try to show what the good was in People's Temple. You know, you see their services. You know, we were lucky; we were able to find an album that the choir recorded. You know, which is like this great gospel music. I mean, it's just, you know, great music. And, you know, we talked to people about, you know, we talked to a lot of People's Temple members, you know, about their experiences, and they talked about, you know, what it was that made them join, what it was that they found there. I think that was fascinating. So I think it was really important for us to say, you know, that there was some good in it, that, you know, that there was something that attracted people. I think that was surprising, you know, what Jim Jones' message was.
Right.
Yeah. And it's powerful, too, because they had a vision of creating a world where complete integration, regardless of social or class structure, and for a while, I mean, it worked. I mean, they were succeeding.
Right. And I think that's another important point. That was another important point for us, is to show that they did succeed for a while. You know, I mean, why did they stay? Well, because, you know, for so many people, they found in People's Temple what they were looking for. You know, they found this integrated society. They found this thing that was a movement that was really trying to change the world, that they were really part of something that was bigger than themselves. You know, one guy told me this great story. He was about 18 when he joined People's Temple, and he said that you know, he would work all day, you know, at one of the People's Temple jobs. And then in the evening, People's Temple ran all these old folks' homes. And he and a bunch of other teenagers would go over to the old people's house, and they would cook dinner. They prepared dinner with the old people. Mm. And then they'd sit and they'd eat, you know, with the old people. And they'd sit, and then they'd sit around, you know, late into the night and just talk. You know, talk, these young people and these old people. And he talked about what a marvelous time that was, you know, in his life, you know. And I know, you know, how it must have been for the elderly people, you know, to have these young people around, to have them cook with them. And,
yeah.
And it just sounded, you know, idyllic, you know. It sounded, wow, that's great. And that's the kind of People Temple we wanted to show, because it was really important to show the good so that you could understand the bad.
Yeah, yeah. And there are only a handful of survivors from that day.
Right. There are only I think 5 people who actually survived the taking of the poison.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 3 or 4 of them are alive now, and 2 of them are in the film. Who actually saw their families die.
And those testimonies are definite emotional highlights of the film. But
yes, they are.
Now, was there hesitation to cooperate? Was there a lot of having to talk them into where you were coming from with this documentary before they?
Well, you know, one thing that we did early on was I said that one thing I was not going to do was try to talk anybody into being part of it. You know, and that we tried to meet with every single member of People's Temple that we could find. You know, because there were besides the 5 people who survived that day, there were a number of people who just didn't happen to be there.
Sure.
They still had people who were stationed in San Francisco, and so there were a number of people who were part of People's Temple who are still living. And we talked to a bunch of them, probably 30 or 40, and I said, you know, I'm not going to try to convince them to be in the film. I'm just not going to do that. I want to try to meet with them, you know, before we film, without a tape recorder, you know, and I would ask them if I could take notes. But I'm not going to try to convince them. And then, you know, I say, you know, we'd like to interview you for the film, but, you know, it's up to you. And I think that honesty, you know, really helped. Because, you know, there were people that we interviewed, a one woman who has teenage kids, and her kids don't even know that she was part of People's Temple.
Mm.
And so I could, you know, I could really understand her not wanting to be in a film.
Sure.
Know? And I understand that, and I totally respected that. And I think the people who did agree to be in the film, you know, did something that was really, really brave to come out and talk about it in public, because so many of them were scorned and laughed at and ostracized when they came back. I mean, people were fired. You know, they came back to the States and they were working, and then people would find out that they had been members of People's Temple. They were fired from their jobs. And,
sure.
You know, they really had to put their lives back together. And a lot of them suffered, you know, a great deal.
Well, yeah, and that's just it, because there's one incredibly haunting testimony. This gentleman discusses having seen his wife and an infant baby dying.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And when you're in the process of filming that kind of testimony on the other side of the camera, I'm interested just in terms of your process. Do you give them space and let them come to that moment themselves? You try not to interfere, because it's really all about having to have the camera record their story, you know, uninterrupted. But
well, one thing that we did in the interviews is to try to lead people through their time in People's Temple chronologically.
Yeah.
So I think that one of the subtle things that happens in the film is they talk about their first day, and we tried to we said, you know, talk about your first day, you know, but as if you don't know the outcome. You know, just go back. This is your first day. I don't want to hear, you know, I really liked it, but if I had only known what was going. Just talk to me about that first day.
Yeah.
And lead me through. Just go, just be in that day. So during the interview, during the film, you kind of see people, it develops, you know, what they thought of People's Temple. So at the beginning, they're very up and they're happy.
Mm.
Until when they talk about that last day, they're pretty devastated. by their experience. And you know, we just try to give them space to let them tell that story. You know, and it's a funny thing as a documentary filmmaker because, you know, as you're getting, you know, these kind of very emotional story, you know, part of you is devastated with the person who's telling the story.
Yeah.
You know, part of you is devastated. But then, you know, let's face it, there's another part of you that's saying, oh, man, this is great.
You know,
I got this great material.
It's
here
gold.
It
yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, don't stop, you know. And it's something that, you know, as a filmmaker, you know, you don't talk about it a lot. You know, you don't talk about it, you know, at screenings, you know, that there's this other side of you that's kind of, you know, saying, yeah, come on, you know, this is beautiful, don't stop.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, obviously you're a filmmaker of great compassion. And I'm sure, like me, your first instinct would be to go over and try to comfort them as they're having this incredibly emotional moment, but you can't, you know. So I often think about that, the difficult position that must be for the documentarian.
Yeah, I mean, I there were a couple of times, especially the story that you're talking about, where guy talks about, you know, having seen his wife and son die, that were just, you know, I mean, it was just really emotionally terrible for me. It's kind of like you feel really, it's just this terrible feeling.
Yeah.
You know, immediately afterwards, because, you know, he's crying and he's devastated by having to tell this story again. And, you know, we just stopped the camera and took a break, you know, and I just was, you know, I'm sorry, you know, I had to do that, you know, and I, you know, but you know, we were going to have to go there, and you know, I'm sorry. But
at the same time, I know that they've probably seen the film. Is there a sense of catharsis for them at this point?
I think so. I mean, they've the people have been really, really supportive and really have really loved the film. I mean, one of the crazy things that happened was the first screening that we had. We rented a little small theater and invited People's Temple members. It was really for them, but we knew we didn't want the whole audience to be People's Temple members, so we invited some friends and family, and then we tried to get as many People's Temple members as we could. And we, before the screening, I said, you know, after the screening, we're not going to have a question and answer. We're going to have, you know, some drinks and food in the lobby, and we can all just mill around and talk about it. And we screened the film, and then we all went out to the lobby, and I looked around and realized that it was all my friends and family, but none of the People's Temple members had come out of the theater.
Huh. You
know? And I went and peeked back in, and they were just sitting there, you know, devastated. You know, and it was, you know, and I didn't know what, you know, if they were devastatedly mad or just what. You know, they sat there for 10, 15 minutes, and they came out and said that, you know, it was a very powerful experience for them, but they thought that it had captured what their experience was in People's Temple better than anything that had been done.
Yeah.
And so they've been great. I mean, they've come to screenings all over the country and have just been really, really, you know, supportive and loving of the film and of me. You know, they've been just great.
Yeah. It has to be kind of a community kind of experience when you work on a documentary or any film. You kind of form your own community, and that's a bond that's hard to break. But I wanted to ask you about Jim Jones himself, and you can see the qualities that kind of made him very powerful and captivating, and his message was very positive for the most part. But what was faulty in him?
He was nuts.
Yeah.
There you have it.
I don't know, you know, how to, you know, put it any other. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the fascinating things is that, you know, we went back and he was, you know, Jim Jones was raised in this really small town in Indiana, rural Indiana, and we went to the town, and it was just really kind of an amazing experience, because we found people who went to school with him when he was a little kid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really, it was those funny experiences where, you know, we're sitting there talking to them, and they're saying, yeah, we used to play with Jim Jones when we were five. They said, yeah, you want to see some pictures of us playing? And they went in the back and brought out these pictures of them, and, you know, these snapshots of them and Jim Jones, like, you know, on their porch at 5 years old and stuff, and they talked about, you know, how he used to kill animals and hold these prayer services for animals and that he would kill and stuff like that, you just realize that early on there was something really off about it.
Yeah.
You know, that it was something, you know, where does that stuff come from? You know, I you know, his parents had passed away a long time ago. He had no brothers and sisters, so you really don't know, you know, if it was, you know, they locked him in a closet or something, or if it was just something that he was born with. But apparently, you know, from early on, he was not, you know, in the
not right
that we would call normal. You know?
Yeah, and I'm curious about what it must be like to be a relative of someone not famous, but infamous, and there's a big difference there. Like Jim Jones, and I know you interviewed Jim Jones Jr.
Yeah,
for the film.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really funny because one thing that I learned in this film, you know, is that so much of how we see events and what we take from it, you know, depends on who we are, you know, and our DNA. So, you know, there are people who are still devastated by what happened, and there are people who seem to be, you know, fairly normal.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things that you know, I came to believe, and this was kind of way after the film, you know, after we had done a number of screenings, and it took me a long time to realize this, was that I think that it really depended on what people lost and how they lost it.
Yeah.
So that the people who kind of brought their families in to People's Temple,
right,
you know, who were responsible, said, you know, one woman said, I'm going to People's Temple, I'm going to join, you know, she said this to her husband and kids, she said, and if you don't want to join, that's fine, but I'm going to leave you, and I'm going to join. And she brought her husband and kids in to People's Temple, and her children ended up dying. And she didn't, because she just didn't happen to be there that night. And she's devastated still. You know, she carries around this aura of sadness with her. With Jim Jones, I think it was very different. Jim Jones Jr., you know. He's Jim Jones' adopted son. So Jim Jones Jr. is African-American,
mm-hmm,
which is just, you know, kind of great. And he, you know, but he, you know, I think that he doesn't feel the responsibility that other people feel.
Yeah.
You know, he was adopted. He was about 18 when the deaths occurred, and you know, his life was turned upside down, and I think he was, you know, devastated for a time. But I think he's been able to get over it because he was not responsible,
right,
for anybody's death.
Yeah, it just has to be a tremendous, absolutely not responsible, but it has to be a tremendous burden. And it's right there in his name. I mean, he hasn't changed his name. His name is Jim Jones Jr.
Right,
right. And he's, you know, and Jim, and he came to a lot of screenings with me, and we spent a lot of time together. And he's someone who I genuinely came to really, really, you know, not only admire but really like as a human being. He's a,
mm-hmm,
a funny guy and a great guy. But you know, he said that, you know, he for a time he called himself, you know, Jimmy Jones or something like that, or James Jones, and he said, you know, in some ways it was disrespectful to the memory of the People's Temple, and to the good of who my father was, and the good of what my family was, for me to try to run around and hide who I am.
Right.
You know, I mean, we went to the screening, and he said this amazing thing, you know, because somebody got up from the audience and said, "Well, do you hate your father?" And he said, you know, look, this is the guy that took me out of an orphanage when I was 3 months old and gave me a life and a family.
Yeah.
This is the guy who, you know, taught me how to shoot a basketball and play basketball with me. This is the guy who would sit down with me and do my homework with me. You know, this is my father, and I loved him for that.
Yeah.
And this is also the guy who devastated my life and devastated so many other people's lives. And I hate him for that. You know, so do I love him or do I hate him? You know, he said, I feel both.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big conflict there.
Excuse me, I have another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
From the chat room. Mr. Nelson, one of our listeners would like to know if any of Mr. Jones' natural children survived.
Yeah, he had one natural child, Stephen Jones, and he did survive. He is not in the film. He did not want to participate in the film, and again, as I said, You know, I just one pact I made with myself was I would not try to convince people to be in the film if they said they didn't want to be in it. And so he's not in the film.
I think if there's one criticism I've read, it's that I've read that it doesn't necessarily answer the question why. I mean, why they did it, and I think you do offer some explanations, but the why is largely unknowable, isn't it?
That's what I think. You know, I mean, I think that our purpose in the film was not to tell you why, because I don't think anybody can ever tell you why.
Yeah.
That's very true.
You know? I mean, so if you can't tell why, does that mean you can't make a film about it? You know, and I don't think that's the case. And so it's something that in some ways we tried to show you what happened,
mm-hmm.
and how it happened, and what led up to it. You know, but I don't know if there ever can be a why. You know, and I don't think that there can ever be a why for us for a lot of reasons. I mean, one is we really don't know on some level why. But I think two, it's impossible for most people to look at in the United States and the society we live in, to look at suicide as being totally irrational.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's one theory that says, you know, that these people made a choice. You know, that they chose to die together, and and that they had established their own culture, in some ways their own world.
Sure.
And in that culture and in that world, to commit suicide together and to choose to die together rather than they felt that they were not going to be able to live together anymore, that their society was going to end. And to make that choice is not irrational within the bounds of their society.
Yeah.
Now, you know, is that something that we wanted to spend, you know, an hour and a half trying to explain to people? No, I don't think it, you know, because I don't think, even if I tell you that, most people are going to say, yeah, sure, you know.
Well, it's over 900 deaths of men, women, and a great number of children, and there's nothing tidy about that. I mean, there's no,
not at all.
Yeah,
no, and I think that in the film we try to show you that you know, there's certainly a good number of those people were murdered. You know?
Yes, yes.
Children, I think there were 250, you know, people who were under 18. You know, they had no choice. They, you know, it wasn't like they understood what was going on.
Yeah,
they were murdered. You know, if you have somebody who's giving you disinformation constantly, as Jim Jones was doing, you know, saying that, you know, that the United States had become a police state, to say, you know, saying that, you know, they were coming to get you, saying that they were going to take away your children, and you have no, I mean, you have to understand that where they were in the middle of the jungle, in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, nowhere. I mean, they had to. To get there, you had to fly to Georgetown, which I defy anybody to point out on a map, you know, in Guyana. To fly down to Georgetown, then you had to take a boat for 24 hours. You had to take the boat out onto the open ocean, then, you know, into a river and down a river, okay? Then you had to get off the boat, you know, and go miles into the jungle.
Yeah.
And that's where they were.
And we're talking no communication,
none.
Or no instruments of communication,
right.
Television,
none.
Or anything. Yeah.
The only instrument of communication they had was Jim Jones,
his voice,
on a loudspeaker,
yeah.
Constantly talking and telling them what was happening and telling them that they were, that, you know, these people were now coming to get them and to kill them. And the only thing that they could do now was to commit suicide. You also had armed guards there to make sure that they took the poison.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think in some ways, you know, that's the why. You know, now why did Jim Jones order it? You know, who knows?
Who knows? Yeah. It's a fantastic film. It's called Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple. And I urge everyone out there to buy it, rent it, find it.
It's an excellent film.
It's a fantastic documentary. What's coming up next for you? What are you working on now?
We're actually just kind of finishing up a film. Jonestown was done for a show on PBS called American Experience, and we're
mm-hmm.
finishing up another film for American Experience. They're doing a huge five-part series on American Indian history, and we're doing the fifth show in the series about a siege at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, between the federal government and armed members of the American Indian Movement and others in 1973.
The incident at Ogallala?
I'm sorry?
It was the incident at Ogallala?
It kind of led to the incident at Ogallala.
Right.
This was the siege that happened right before that.
Right, okay.
71-day standoff between the federal government. It wasn't a standoff. There were something like 130,000 rounds of ammunition.
Oh, that's right, yes. Oh, my.
Into this compound, and it's kind of this defining moment for so many people of American Indian descent.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
When do you expect that to air? You have a.
That's not going
to
air until 2009 because it's part of a series that American Experience is doing. So they're doing this. The shows are all all in production now, but it won't air until 2009.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I hope I get a chance to talk to you before 2009.
Yes.
Well, but if not, will you at least come back and talk to us when that project comes closer?
Anytime.
Well, that's wonderful.
Great.
Thank you so much,
Thank
sir.
You.
I appreciate you coming on, and it's been an honor to speak with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye
Thank
now.
You.
That is Stanley Nelson, the director of Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple. As harrowing a documentary as you are ever likely to see, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But a great film and a great filmmaker. Man, we've had great people on tonight.
Yeah, we had just an incredible 90 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. You get a little choked up there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm getting choked up, yes.
Okay, great, guys. The chat room's been great.
Yeah, the chat room's been wonderful. Thank you to everyone in the chat room and to all of our listeners out there.
Thank you all. And B, don't forget to tune in to Alan Levy Show tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Alan Levy on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/AlanLevy.
That's right.
CEO. We will be interviewed. Anything
we'll be
you want to know about.
It will be worth it. Do it.
Bombard him with phone calls. You have questions to ask about us.
He
we know
can
you
ask
do.
Questions now, though, or anytime, too. Please feel free to call in anytime while we're... Especially when it's just the three of us.
Yeah, especially when it's just us. But and also stay tuned to the blogs and postings, blog postings, bulletin postings for announcement of a possible trivia contest for prize.
Possible. We're not sure yet.
Yeah, we're not sure, but in the next 2 days we'll know. And if you want to add us on your MySpace, we're Movie Geeks United.
That's right.
On MySpace, so please add us on.
Who are you going to call?
Movie Geeks United. Thanks. Thanks, everyone, for listening in, joining us on the chat room or just on the regular show feed, and we'll see you back Sunday night.
Sunday night. Thanks, everyone. Good night.
Bye-bye.